over Baba Yar.
With accounts and recordings from its 1962 premiere.
The atmosphere that day was fantastically tense.
And the parallels with the situation in Kyiv today.
I can talk about it. I'm no longer scared of anything.
Shostakovich and the Battle for Babi Yar. This evening at 6:45 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday. Next, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is Rabbi Jonathan Romain.
Rabbi, writer and broadcaster Jonathan Romain is minister of Maidenhead Synagogue and one of Britain's leading rabbis in Reform Judaism. He's the author of 20 books, some scholarly and learned, and others which are just very funny, revealing the ups and downs of his day-to-day work in a way which will resonate with vicars, priests and religious leaders of any description. He's also become a kind of agony uncle, dispensing advice on love affairs, marriage, parenthood, and he's written about all this in Confessions of a Rabbi and in his latest book, The Naked Rabbi. Some of his advice I found quite surprising, of which more later. On the more serious side, he's a prominent figure in the campaign for assisted dying. He was awarded an MBE for his work on interfaith marriage, and he spent much of the last year working with Ukrainian refugees. Well, lots to explore over the next hour there, Jonathan, but let's get down to the music, because your playlist takes in Leonard Cohen, Rimsky-Korsakov, and a tribute to your love of football. But we're going to begin with Max Bruch and a famous cello piece called Nidre, which was inspired by Jewish folk music and, of course, ritual.
Yes, and it's very curious because Max Bruch was not Jewish, and yet he wrote one of the most revered Jewish compositions. It's the Kol Nidre prayer, which actually is not even Hebrew, it's Aramaic, and it's said or sung at the start of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which is often considered to be one of the holiest days of the year. And it's all about forgiveness of the promises we've broken. It is, by the way, a prayer that later became associated with the Muranos. These were the secret Jews of Spain. After they got expelled en masse by Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492, and many left, but some who had been literally there for 1,000 years felt they couldn't leave Spanish culture, and therefore they converted to Catholicism in order to be able to not be Jews officially and stay. And yet, of course, they had to make Catholic promises and prayers, and so once a year this Kol Nidre was their sort of way of atoning for all the false vows that they'd made whilst in church.
And what Bruch does here is he gives the cello the voice of the cantor.
Thank you.
Natalie Klein performing music from Kol Nidre by Max Brook. Ilan Volkov was conducting the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. You say that the question you most dread is why you became a rabbi. So I'm not going to ask you that, but why is it such a difficult question?
Well, because people have high expectations. They expect a heavenly voice to boom out and say, Jonathan, I need you. Or maybe a sort of a revelation, usually on a mountaintop or by a waterfall, and ideally with an orchestra in the background. And maybe that's more true of Christians, where there is a definite sense of calling. But for me, it was just, I always wanted to be a rabbi ever since I can remember, say from 11 or 12 or something like that. And it was partly because I suppose I just liked Judaism and being Jewish, and partly because I thought it would be a useful way of spending my life. My father, by the way, was horrified. Yes. He thought I'd be sort of living in an ivory tower and just immersed in texts and divorced from reality. But in fact, quite the opposite. It's immersed in people and the way of life. And it's a wonderful job because you see everything that's going right and also going wrong.
Once you made that decision, you had to choose a course between two very different traditions, the Orthodox and the Reform branches of Judaism. Now, you're very much on the Reform side. What do you believe that the Orthodox wouldn't perhaps approve of in your attitude to Judaism?
It's the C word, change. And it's not just in Judaism, but this is a common theme between all the phases, between the Orthodox or the fundamentalist, and then the Reform, the modern, the progressive, the Protestant, and the ability to change, and the ability to say that Revelation wasn't just a one-off at Mount Sinai, at Golgotha, wherever, but there's the concept of progressive revelation, that every generation is understanding or trying to understand the will of God in its own time. And therefore, for instance, if you went to an Orthodox synagogue, men and women would be seated separately, whereas we see women as totally equal. It feels it's almost silly to say it. Now, you know, the Orthodox, again, in Judaism and Christianity, or Islam, whatever, will go back to the Bible and say, thou shalt not. Well, we all say, well, OK, what was relevant 2,000 years ago in a different sort of society isn't relevant today. And we try and marry the best of tradition with the insights of modernity.
Would you say that the two arms, as you've described them, have managed to come together at all recently, or perhaps even gone further apart? I don't know.
Certainly in this country, there has been a coming together. And whereas beforehand, there was sort of quite a lot of, you know, ding-dongs and insults and sermons against each other, now we recognise that that's not helpful. It doesn't achieve anything. We're not going to change anything. And it's much better to live together and accept that there are different interpretations. It's a battle that goes on within all faiths, really.
Well, our next music is not a million miles removed from what we've been talking about. It's by Leonard Cohen from an album called New Skin for the Old Ceremony. Tell us a little bit about these quite complex lyrics. It's a modern setting of an ancient liturgy, isn't it?
Yes, it comes from a prayer called Unatani Tokef, written by, I think, Avraham of Mainz in the 10th century. And it's at the High Holy Day period, and looking at what's happened and what's going to happen, and particularly who will live and who will die in the next year, which was assumed to be in God's hands, and how it would happen, who would perish by fire, who by water, who by human hand. And Leonard Cohen adapts this and puts it also in a modern context, in the sense that he adds things like, and who will die by barbiturates, for instance, and also this very telling line that he has, who is calling? In other words, who's going to determine our fate? Is it chance? Is it God? Is it ourselves? Is it other people? And Leonard Cohen's a very interesting character because, on the one hand, he has this image of being a sort of a radical, a free spirit, and yet his writings and his lyrics are deeply influenced by religious images, not just his Jewish roots, but also Christianity and Buddhism, both of which he knew well.
Shall I say, is calling? And who in her lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in these realms above, who by something blunt, who by avalanche, who by powder, for his greed, who for his hunger, and who shall I say is calling? And who by brave ascent, who by accident, who in solitude, who in this mirror, his latest command, who by his own hand, who in mortal chains, who in power, and who shall I say is calling?
Fire from Leonard Cohen, 1974. Let's talk about your work as an agony uncle, if we may, Jonathan. Over the years, people in your synagogue have come to you with their problems, and you also write a problem page in the Jewish Chronicle. So to give some examples of recent columns, is online betting kosher? No. Is it okay to go into a church? Yes. Does a dog have a soul? Well, what's the answer to that one?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
It's a rather sweet question, and it came from the father of a boy after the family dog died, yeah. Didn't it?
Yes, certainly I would say that dogs are very precious parts of the family, and even, I mean, certainly when there's a family, but even more so when someone's living alone, and their dog is their partner and their companion, and there's an enormous sense of grief and loss when they pass away. And so, the more common question is not whether they have a soul, but can I do a burial, can I do a funeral, can I say a prayer? Because, and although some rabbis would dismiss that as nonsense, you know, it's only for humans, I would certainly help, because a pet is part of the family. Mm.
I was quite surprised reading your books to learn how much you're called on to answer questions about the very intimate lives of the people in your synagogue. And you're not only relaxed about the fact that some marriages are just not worth saving, you don't mind. In fact, I think you even find you've got to get to the heart of the matter by probing quite openly about, really, do you still have sex, for example?
Yes, I mean, that question comes up when a couple come to me and they talk about their problems. And I actually ask that question usually within the first 5 minutes, and there's a sudden sort of like, shock, and their eyes open, and how dare he ask you a question like that, and why is he probing? But I find, partly because it does get to the nub of the matter, because actually, time and time again, and this isn't a rule, but it's a generalisation, if a couple, yes, they have rows, but they're still making love every now and then, and still cuddling in bed, it means there is a connection, there's a bond, there's a basic affection and affinity. If actually, as one couple told me, well, we haven't slept together for 8 years, then you know something's seriously wrong, unless there's a particular medical reason for it.
So you believe in taking the shortcut to get to the core of the matter?
Yes, and actually I had a very good training, because for several years I was literally the agony uncle or agony rabbi on LBC radio. Mm. And of course we were confined by the fact that we had to deal with someone between the adverts, so we only had about 7 minutes to sort someone's life out. And of course the other thing about radio is you can't be silent and ponder and have deep looking into their eyes, you've got to just keep going.
Not everybody that's listening to us now will probably know that Judaism is more relaxed about divorce than Christianity, isn't it?
Judaism has always taken this attitude that, you know, marriage can be wonderful if it works, but if it doesn't, well, okay, it's not a prison, not a life sentence, and the hope is that not only can they get divorced, but they can get remarried. And I don't know about you, but certainly your listeners will often know that actually it's the second marriage that can be the better marriage.
And amongst your advice, which some may find surprising, is the fact that you feel that honesty isn't always the best policy in relationships, that sometimes it's better to cover the truth in the interests of just causing pain.
Yes, I mean, one particular episode was when a man came to me and he said he wanted to confess about his adultery, and he wanted to tell his wife, and he wasn't sure about how to tell her. And in fact, it was a situation where there was very little likelihood of her finding out. I mean, if there was, then obviously it was right for him to tell her so that she hears from him first. But in this particular case, I say, well, why tell her? You know, all you're doing is offloading your guilt onto her and upsetting her for no particular reason. And if you want to make amends, then be a good husband and be faithful. Mm. And in that particular case, I know I was right, because that was 20 years ago, and I know the couple who are still together. And if I asked her, she would say she has the most wonderful husband in the world.
Let's hope she doesn't listen to this and think, I wonder. And as a reform rabbi, you don't have a problem marrying same-sex couples, do you?
No. This is fairly new, I should say, within the last 10 years. And we've realised that, you know, at the end of the day, if you believe in God, then and you believe that God is behind creation, then God created people lesbian or gay, and therefore, who am I to deny their godliness or goodness? Mm.
Rimsky-Korsakov next, and I think you've got quite an interesting story behind this choice.
Oh, this is because this is the first piece of classical music that I ever heard. My father brought it home one day. I was quite young, I don't know, 7 or 8, and he was very much self-educated man because of the war. He went to a different school every year for about 7 or 8 years. And later on, he went to night school. Later on, he did the Open University. And he brought this home because he wanted to educate himself musically as well. And I was just entranced. It was just magical.
Thank you.
Vasily Petrenko conducting the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra in music from Scheherazade, The Sea and Sinbad's Ship by Rimsky-Korsakov. Music you discovered in your childhood, Jonathan. Your mother's family had been murdered in the Holocaust, and I wonder how much you were aware of the dark shadow of the war growing up.
Yes, I have a very early memory of it. I was just sitting on my mother's lap, and I must have been, I don't know, 4 or 5, something like that. And she was showing me the family photo album, saying, "This is my cousin, this is my aunt, and this is." And I said, "Well, hang on, I've never met any of them." And then from being a very sort of friendly and smiley, she suddenly went very cold and said, "No, and you never will," and closed the book. And I always thought that was odd. And, of course, it was only years later that I realised they were the ones that didn't get out. And I actually had a large family, but only 3 of whom came to this country. And they all died or killed in Auschwitz. It was an awareness from a very early age.
It's interesting the way guilt plays out among survivors from that point of view, isn't it?
Yes, and my mother, for instance, never went back to Germany, whereas other people did. She felt that the Germany and what it stood for had been poisoned for her. And I did go to Germany myself a couple of times for interfaith conferences, and the first time I felt really, really bad going there. And it was like I was entering a national prison camp, which was not true. It was just my feelings based on the unconscious vibes I'd received from my upbringing.
One concern I know has been the dwindling of the Jewish community during this generation as people marry out. And you've said some pretty controversial things about this. You don't think it's a problem, do you, if Jews marry people of other religions?
Well, there is a possible problem, I put it like that, because I suppose any minister of religion wants people to marry within their faith, fellow Sikh, fellow Catholic, partly to continue the faith for themselves, but also so it goes to the next generation. And there's always a danger that if you have a mixed-faith marriage, then the religion won't go to the next generation. And therefore, until recently, those couples were completely ostracised, which seemed to me absolutely bonkers, because, number one, that guaranteed if you pushed them away and you would literally ring up a rabbi or a Catholic priest and say, "I'm marrying somebody of a different faith," the phone would go slam down. And this is what we're talking about in the 1970s, 80s. And that would just make sure that they had nothing to do with the church or synagogue. One of the reasons my own synagogue, Maidenhead, has grown enormously, by which I mean when I came it was about 70 families, now it's 900, is precisely because we've taken down the barbed wire and put up the welcome sign and said it doesn't matter if you're in a mixed-faith marriage or single or gay or whatever, you are welcome as you are.
You avoided all this controversy in your own personal life by the simple expedient, Jonathan, of marrying another rabbi. In fact, you were the first two rabbis, I think, to get married in 1981. What's it like being married to another rabbi?
Oh, good fun. in fact, I find it impossible to think of being married to someone who isn't a rabbi. We don't see a lot of each other because we're both working in our own different congregations, but it's enormously valuable to actually be able to share not just home life and family and children, but also our professional lives, rather than make them sort of no-go areas.
So music next for your wife, Sybil Sheridan. This is Klezmer.
Yes, klezmer is actually a Hebrew word, klezmer, which means musical instrument. And it is, as you say, quintessentially Jewish. And it's characterised by exuberancy, dance, very often at weddings, but anything to celebrate a party or whatever. Very often it's sort of, it's a mixture of violin and clarinet and cello. And often not with words, but with sort of exclamations, you know, oi, or sigh, or yeah, a groan, yeah, or whatever.
Thank you. Warsaw Celebration, performed by The Burning Bush. And of course, you can find all the details of the choices of my guest today, Jonathan Romain, if you go to the Private Passions webpage. And if you go to BBC Sounds, there are hundreds of past programmes to download. I mentioned when we started, Jonathan, that you've become an outspoken advocate of assisted dying. And I think this was directly because of a personal experience you had.
Yes, as a minister of religion, I do a lot of visits to hospitals and hospices, and of course they do wonderful work to try and look after people, but there comes a point where some people just are in so much pain or distress that they want to give up, and hospitals and hospices aren't allowed to let them do that. And there was one particular day when I went to visit somebody, and he was literally on his bed, on his knees, and in complete agony, and I just thought, this can't be right. And therefore, after sort of, and this was a culmination of seeing such people, and I thought that it must be right that if somebody is terminally ill, in other words, they are dying already, not like in their 40s having a depression and a bad moment, but actually dying, they've only got a few weeks or even a couple of months left to go, and they're in pain, and they wish to let go of their life, and they are mentally competent, so not dementia, but mentally competent, able to make a decision, then why not allow them to do so? And therefore, I joined the assisted dying movement, which is Dignity in Dying. In fact, I'm the vice chair of Dignity in Dying. And it seems to me, both as a human being, but also from a religious perspective, it is the right thing to do, because or the right thing to allow people that choice, because there's nothing sacred about suffering, there's nothing holy about agony. And if people want to let go of life and say to God, thank you very much, but it's time to call an end, then why not let them?
We know from opinion polls that most of the population agree with your view that assisted dying should be legal in some circumstances. But religious leaders of virtually all the faiths are against it, as indeed are other Jewish leaders. So you're really out on a limb, because they say this is for God to choose, not for us.
Yes, and that is, to be honest, the traditional view. So I'm in a minority, I would say a growing minority, and there's clearly a disconnect between the religious hierarchy and perhaps the religious community at large. And it's certainly true that until now, suicide has been seen as the great no-no, and thou shalt not, it's only in God's hands. But, you know, there's that lovely verse in Ecclesiastes where it says a time for this and a time for that and a time to be born and a time to die. What's interesting is it doesn't say who chooses, and maybe it should be us.
What does it feel like to be in a minority, to go against the majority view in your own religion?
Oh, it's not pleasant, and I never deliberately court controversy, and in many ways I am a sort of a normal congregational rabbi and do sort of most things that an ordinary rabbi or vicar will do, whether it's a hatch, match and dispatch or leading services and educating children and adults. But there are particular causes which I do feel very strongly about, and I just feel impelled, as almost part of the sort of prophetic tradition, that these are the things that, however unpopular, need to be said.
One of the pieces of music which I think helps you to keep going when you're under fire, if you like, is the music from Chariots of Fire.
Oh, yes. I was blown away by when I saw the film, partly because of the content of this tenacity, the effort, the courage, the aspiration, and ultimately the triumph of the runners, and particularly Harold Abrahams, who was a Jewish student, who then went on, despite quite a lot of prejudice, to win the gold in the 100 metres. And we're talking about the music by Vangelis. And to be honest, if ever I'm feeling down, then that's what I'll listen to.
Music from the soundtrack to Chariots of Fire by Vangelis, who indeed graced our studio on one occasion and contributed his private passions. You mentioned anti-Semitism just now, Jonathan Remain, and we were talking in a historical context. But of course, anti-Semitism is still very much alive, and I wonder how much you've been aware of that in your lifetime, and especially recently.
Well, when I was a child, I experienced it historically from knowing about my family history, my mother coming here from Nazi Germany when she was on the Kinder transport in 1939. And I've always been grateful to Britain for giving that hospitality. At school, I got bullied a little bit, not a lot, but because I was Jewish, it was just... And I sort of almost grew up with a sort of acceptance of a latent anti-Semitism, and that I was different in that respect. For a lot of Jews, unfortunately, is true. They're sort of used to being a little bit different, and there's always going to be somebody who, if they don't punch you in the nose, they will certainly make an unpleasant remark. And you learn to live with that, because people can be unpleasant. I'm pleased to say that actually in Maidenhead, which is where I'm working at the synagogue, that's extraordinarily rare. In fact, after 9/11 occurred, I went to the mosque and said a prayer for peace in Hebrew in the mosque, and the imam came back to the synagogue and said a prayer for peace in Arabic. It didn't change the world, but there are many parts of the country you got shot for that.
I mentioned also at the beginning your work with Ukrainian refugees. I know that's taken a huge amount of your time, but how did that start and how is it continuing?
Well, when Putin started massing his troops on the border, it seemed to be quite obvious he was going to invade. And I contacted a number of charities and said, look, when this happens, I'd like to host anybody and a refugee. And they said, oh, well, let's wait and see. And that seemed to me daft. You know, don't wait and see, act and be ready. And so therefore, I set up what was initially called Ukraine Transport to help, based partly on the Kinder's transport, which had rescued my own mother in 1939. And it was partly a sort of humanitarian response and partly an awareness of what had happened back then, and now it's the sort of turn of my generations to step up to the mark. And since then, I founded a charity called Open Arms, which is involving hosting, but also teaching Ukrainians English lessons, and also we give them bicycles. It seems a simple thing, but it's enormously important because it allows them to get around, yes. Whether it's the kids to get to school or the people to get to work or shopping or whatever, and it takes the burden off their hosts, who are already doing a lot, from having to chauffeur them as well. And everyone's got a bike in their shed and their garage, and we've been sort of collecting them and redistributing them.
So that must be very satisfying for you to do something in return for what people did for your mother.
Yes, I mean, as I say, it's a mixture of both my own personal history, but just responding on a humanitarian level. And yes, I do see myself as almost sort of completing the circle.
We're going to hear music now which connects nicely with that, because it's a song of thanksgiving for hospitality, isn't it?
Yes, this is Bendigamos. It's a Spanish song, and it means let us bless. It's a Sephardi grace after meals, and Sephardi have their own language. Everyone knows about Yiddish. Sephardi have their own language, Ladino. This isn't Ladino. It's pure Spanish. And it's really interesting how Ladino has not survived, whereas Yiddish has. And in fact, people will use all sorts of Yiddish words. It always intrigues me, like schlep or schmooze or chutzpah. By the way, do you know what the definition of chutzpah is?
Tell me.
No, there's a famous definition. There's a man in court, and he's being sentenced for murder because he killed his mother and his father. And when the judge is about to sentence him, he makes a plea for leniency. And the judge says, on what grounds? And he says, look, I'm an orphan. That's chutzpah. So cheek, but cheek with a special attitude.
Bendigamos al Altísimo, al Señor que nos crió. Démosle agradecimiento por los bienes que nos crió. Alabado sea su santo nombre, porque siempre nos ha piado. Loada al Señor que es bueno, que para siempre su merced. Bendigamos al Altísimo por el primeramente que liga
al cielo continuamente. Alabado sea su santo nombre, porque siempre nos ha guiado. Gloria al Señor que es bueno, que para siempre su
Clive Hyman directing the London Jewish Male Choir in Bendigamos. The soloist was Maurice Martin and the pianist Yvonne Behar. A hymn of thanksgiving for a good meal. We've talked a lot about problems today, the crisis in Ukraine, problems in British society, problems in marriage. But I know you think it's an important part of your job as a rabbi, Jonathan, to remind us of the really good things in life. And of course, you often use humour in your sermons, which is a cue for you to tell us your favourite Jewish joke.
Oh, right. This ties in with the one of the great religious developments of the last 50, 60 years, which is, despite all the problems of the past, the interfaith dialogue, which has really flourished, and it's wonderful. And there's a story of a rabbi and a priest, a Catholic priest, who are having their sort of weekly dinner together. And the priest leans over and says, tell me, Rabbi, I know it's banned, but have you ever eaten pork? And the rabbi says, how dare you ask me that? And he says, no, come on, we're friends, you can tell me. So the rabbi brushes and says, well, yes, I did. Says the priest, nice, isn't it? So the rabbi thinks, and then he sort of says, well, OK, let's swap. Tell me, I know as a priest you're supposed to be celibate. Have you ever slept with a woman? The priest is horrified. My goodness me, he says. No, come on, be honest. He said, well, actually, yes, I did, once. Ah, said the rabbi. Nicer than pork, isn't it?
Very good. Well, we're going to end on music, which might also amuse people. I don't think it's ever been chosen before on the programme. But for you, it represents a very deep passion. Football. It's the Match of the Day theme, isn't it? Composed in 1970 by Barry Stoller.
Yes, that's the only television programme I ever watched. I never have time to watch television. But Saturday night, oh yes, 10:30. And I am a very keen football fan. To say, if you're asking, I support the mighty Reading Football Club in Championship League. And what really interests me is the actual parallels between football and faith. There's a sort of special regalia that you wear either to church, synagogue, or to football matches. They've each got their unique calendar. The singing, of course, whether it's the hymns or the chants, the camaraderie, and of course the faith. You know, you keep on going to church even when your prayers aren't answered, or you keep on going to matches even when your team loses. And my dream is to transfer the sort of enthusiasm and the camaraderie and the sort of singing that you get at football matches to my community.
Well, you can imagine that Reading topping the Premier League as we listen to this theme and you're about to see Match of the Day where they win. A lovely note on which to end. Rabbi Jonathan Remain, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The original Match of the Day theme, written and performed in his basement by Barry Stoller, ending that edition of Private Passions, presented by Michael Barclay, whose guest was Rabbi Jonathan Remain. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. Private Passions takes a break for Christmas and will return in January. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by Jane Royce. The Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, has said it is up to nurses and the NHS to settle a dispute about pay, rebuffing calls from the Royal College of Nursing for ministers to negotiate salaries. Walkouts by members of the RCN are planned for the 15th and the 20th of December in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. The organisation has said it will pause the strikes if the government comes to the negotiating table. Police in Jersey say the number of people who died in an explosion at a block of flats could rise to around 15. Three people are known to have been killed following the blast in St Helier yesterday morning. Specialist teams are still searching for more victims, and their rescue operation has become a recovery one. Officers say the search could take weeks. Scottish authorities say a Libyan man accused of making the bomb which destroyed a passenger plane over Lockerbie more than 30 years ago is in US custody. The Pan Am flight came down over the town in December 1988, killing all 270 people on board. American authorities announced charges against Abu Aguila Massoud 2 years ago, alleging he played a key role in the bombing. Ukraine says around 1.5 million people are without power after intense fighting in the south of the country. The army says it shot down 10 drones yesterday in Odessa, but another 5 hit energy facilities. President Zelensky has warned it'll take days to restore electricity. A teenage girl has been cleared of cancer thanks to a medical breakthrough. 13-year-old Alyssa from Leicester was diagnosed with an aggressive form of leukaemia last year, and initial efforts to treat her failed. Doctors at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London gave her edited cells from a healthy donor. 6 months on, she's free of cancer and is said to be recovering well at home. An average of 19.4 million people watched England's defeat to France in the World Cup quarter-final last night. The ITV audience peaked at more than 21 million near the end of the match, making it the most watched TV moment on a single channel this year. The weather feeling cold in most areas this afternoon. Cloudy in the south with a chance of snow, but the snow showers will ease in parts of Scotland. Highs of 4 degrees Celsius in Belfast, 3 in Edinburgh, 2 in Cardiff and 0 in London. BBC News.
Out of all Shostakovich's symphonies, the 13th stands apart.
Join me, Lucy Ash, as I tell the story of how a Holocaust massacre in Ukraine inspired one of the greatest choral works of the 20th century.
No monument stands over Baba Yar.
With accounts and recordings from its 1962 premiere.
The atmosphere that day was fantastically tense.
And the parallels with the situation in Kyiv today.
I can talk about